This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. For over a decade, the IBM Center for the Business of Government has sought to connect research to practice, sponsoring third-party research on a broad range of public management issues facing us today. In only four cases since 1975, has the U.S. Congress passed all appropriation bills before the beginning of the fiscal year. In some years, like 1996, inaction led to agencies suspending operations. This year, Congress adopted a six-month continuing resolution for all fiscal year 2013 appropriation bills, delaying final decision until March 31st. What do these delays mean for how agencies manage their monies and operations? How do funding delays affect grantees and contractors? What does all this talk about the impending fiscal cliff really mean? And just what is a continuing resolution? And how can the federal budget process be improved? Today, we'll explore these questions and so much more with Professor Phil Joyce, a budget expert at the University of Maryland and author of the recent IBM Center report, The Cost of Budget Uncertainty, Analyzing the Impacts of Late Appropriations. This report examines the impact of late budgets over the past 37 years and identifies useful coping strategies while offering recommendations on how to soften the adverse effects of budget uncertainty. Welcome, Professor Joyce. It's great to have you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Great. Before we delve into your recent IBM Center report, The Cost of Budget Uncertainty, Analyzing the Impacts of Late Appropriations, I'd like to provide some context and explain certain realities that beset our period. First things first, would you elaborate on what is meant today by the coming fiscal cliff, and what are the conditions that precipitated this situation?
Well, it's a good question, and of course, it's a question that lots of people are asking right now in Washington. The fiscal cliff results from many factors, and the thing that they all have in common is that they're all self-inflicted. There are really two big components of the fiscal cliff. First, the Bush tax cuts that were passed in 2001 and then 2003 were sunset in order to make them more affordable. But what that means is that while they were kind of phased in a little at a time, they all go away at once. And when a tax cut goes away, it means people are experiencing a big tax increase. So people are right now slated to experience a big tax increase as of the beginning of January. The second is that when the so-called super committee in 2011 failed to reach agreement on a set of spending cuts and tax increases to cut $1.2 trillion from the budget deficit, there was a process put in place called sequestration, which is a set of automatic spending cuts that are also scheduled to take effect at the same time. So if you add those two things together plus a number of other sort of little things or smaller things, there's a total of about $5 trillion worth of tax increases and spending cuts over 10 years that's scheduled to go into effect. And that's what people describe as the fiscal cliff. Now, as I say, the fiscal cliff, if it is a cliff, and I sort of prefer to think of it as a slope more than a cliff, because it's not like a government shutdown or even a debt ceiling failure where kind of really bad things happen all at once. It's more that over a long period of time, you're going to have, you know, less spending and you're going to have higher taxes. But the cliff is really, the existence of the cliff is a failure of our politics. That is, it's the failure of our ability to kind of come together and put together a budget that is really sort of consistent with what a budget ought to be, which is kind of trying to match up spending and revenues. And so we built it, you know, kind of block by block or stone by stone. The problem is not really a disagreement, I think, about whether the deficit needs to be cut, which it does need to be cut. I think the basic problem is that if you just let the fiscal cliff kick in, then it's going to happen in a very sort of unreflected way. And so what people are looking for now is not trying to necessarily avoid having the deficit cut, but do it in a more sort of responsible and considered way. And that, of course, is the difficulty, because the reason we have this to begin with is because people haven't been able to agree on, one party says it doesn't want to raise taxes, another party says it doesn't want to touch entitlements. So the question is, given this looming deadline, really, the fiscal cliff deadline, are they going to be able to get together and do something now?
So, Professor Joyce, what has led to the current dysfunction of the federal budget process? And more importantly, has the apparent erosion of consensus among participants led to where we are today? And will just reforming the process bring back or resuscitate that consensus?
It's a very good question. I think that the answer to the first question really sort of logically flows into the answer to the second. It is such a political problem and so much not a procedural problem that I am one who's very skeptical about the ability of the process to do anything about it. But let's go back to why we have the dysfunction that we have. I think the short answer is that political leaders, and I use the term advisedly, care more about gaining partisan advantage than they do about governing, and they do about making sure that government operates well. I don't mean this as a partisan statement necessarily. It's just an example. But sometime, I don't know when it was, 2009, 2010, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell in the Senate made the statement that the primary goal of the Republican Party was to make President Obama a one-term president. That is not a recipe for governing. It's not a recipe for achieving consensus. And so if both parties are trying to kind of look and see how they can gain political advantage over the other one, it doesn't encourage them to compromise. Now, part of what I think is kind of symptomatic of this is that we don't have many moderates left in either the House of Representatives or the Senate. There used to be not a majority, but at least a sort of critical mass of people who were in the middle. But they were very important because they helped things get done. And so you could get a coalition of moderates of both parties to align with some Republicans on one side or some Democrats on the other side in order to get things done. Increasingly, the parties are very polarized. Now, there's a number of reasons for that, including redistricting, which has led in part to this polarization because both parties have been trying to create a larger number of sort of safe districts for their members. So you have heavily Republican districts, heavily Democratic districts. But the fact is that you just haven't had a lot of people expressing moderate views. Now, there is some good news here, which is that if you've been following some of the discussions on these fiscal cliff debates, there are some people on both sides, and I think especially in the Senate as opposed to the House, who've begun to express more moderate views on issues such as taxes and entitlements. It's not a choice between raising taxes and cutting spending. It is raising taxes and cutting spending, and the question is just which taxes and what spending.
Exactly. Well, this dysfunction, which you've outlined, does have consequences, and it either leads to government shutdown or the increasing use of continuing resolutions or CRs. Could you tell us a little bit more about what a continuing resolution is, and give us a little bit about the history?
A continuing resolution is literally a short-term appropriation. It is an appropriation typically which covers a portion of a fiscal year. And the reason it's called a continuing resolution is because it is allowing agencies to continue to spend at the level that they already are spending. That's a kind of classic continuing resolution. So if you had an appropriation for fiscal year 2012 and you had a continuing resolution for fiscal year 2013, it would just say continue doing all the stuff in fiscal year 2013 that you were doing in fiscal year 2012, but you can't do anything new and you can't stop doing anything that you were already doing. So that's a kind of classic continuing resolution. Now, the history here is a little bit interesting because continuing resolutions have been around for a long time. I mean, their continuing resolutions, I think, have been around, for most of this century. But there was no particular consequence to failing to enact appropriation bills by the beginning of the fiscal year until 1980, when the Attorney General at that time, Benjamin Civiletti, who was President Carter's last Attorney General, issued an opinion, and that opinion essentially said federal agencies are not permitted to enter into obligations, that is, to spend money in absence of an appropriation. Believe it or not, prior to that, even if there had not been an appropriation passed by the beginning of the fiscal year, federal agencies would continue to spend money because essentially they were taking the position that Congress couldn't have meant that. Congress couldn't have meant to stop funding them. But the Attorney General said, you can't make the assumption that Congress didn't mean that. The fact is that if there's not an appropriation, you don't have the legal authority to spend money. So after that point, after 1980, if agencies didn't have appropriations, it meant they had to cease operations. Now, of course, this then led to sort of obvious questions, which is, okay, what if you're in the middle of a war? Do you, at midnight on September 30th, just kind of put your guns away and, you know, and leave the battlefield because you don't have an appropriation? So this led to the whole concept of exceptions and the fact that there were essential services that needed to continue. And then the question sort of came down to, okay, well, what is essential and what is non-essential? Initially, there was a pretty broad definition of what was essential, but then there was a kind of separate opinion that said, you know, this idea of essentiality, if you will, you know, was not quite as elastic a concept as people might think. And so we had kind of much tighter rules in terms of what's essential and not essential. You know, the main issue, and really one of the main issues that I was trying to focus on in this report, is just to kind of shine light on the fact that it has become the norm rather than the rule to have continuing resolutions. And that the impacts of those continuing resolutions are relatively invisible. What you are trying to avoid is very visible. That is, a government shutdown, even if it doesn't encompass the whole government, it always led to things like, you know, a padlock on the gates at Yellowstone National Park, you know, people not being able to do things, people going to Social Security offices to file for new benefits and, you know, there was no one home. So all of those things were visible. But the effect of continuing resolutions is more sort of invisible. But the motivation for sort of talking about this is that this is not a world where government shutdowns are bad, but continuing resolutions are okay. It's a matter of kind of which bad you want to choose, you know, because the continuing resolutions have their own sort of costs.
Well, in diagnosing the problem, your report does a wonderful job providing historical context around things like the CR or shutdown.
Right.
And I'd like for you to touch on the government shutdown concept. And you acknowledge that the term shutdown is not entirely accurate. Would you elaborate on why this is the case? And I think you alluded to it earlier.
Well, that's right. The reason it's not accurate is because in the first place, when there is a shutdown, the whole government doesn't shut down because there is this provision for some things being declared as essential. But it's actually even a little broader than that, which is that the Congress, when I was describing the appropriations process earlier, I didn't say that – I said the Congress has an appropriations process. I didn't say that that appropriations process actually at this point consists of the Congress passing 12 different appropriations bills. So those 12 appropriations bills are organized at least broadly according to government functions, although in some cases it's kind of hard to make sense out of why certain agencies are in appropriations bills together. But the fact is that most of the years, even when we have had a government shutdown imminent or threatened or even one that has occurred, it hasn't encompassed the entire government because there have been some appropriation bills that have actually been passed and signed into law prior to the beginning of the fiscal year. The last government shutdown we had was late 1995, early 1996. But for example, the Agriculture Department never shut down during that entire period of time, not because everyone in the Agriculture Department is considered to be essential, but because the Agriculture Department had an appropriations bill. The legislative branch had an appropriations bill, but the Interior Department, for example, did not have an appropriations bill. And so you might have a situation where, you know, you have an employee of the Department of Agriculture, an employee of the Department of the Interior, both working in the same area of the country, but the Agriculture Department employee is at work the Interior Department employee is not because the Agriculture Department employee is essential and the Interior Department employee is not, but because the Agriculture Department has an appropriations bill and the Interior Department does not. So it's much more complicated than to just say that either the government shuts down or the government does not shut down.
So, Professor Joyce, another term has entered our popular imagination, and that is sequestration. And I'd like to understand, what exactly is sequestration, and what's the implication were it to go into effect January 2013?
The first is that there was something called the Budget Control Act, and the Budget Control Act was what was passed by the Congress as, in a sense, a cost of the Congress agreeing to this increase in the debt ceiling in August of 2011. And when the Budget Control Act was passed, it created this new Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction, which most people refer to as the super committee, although in retrospect it wasn't so super. But what happened was that the law said if the super committee reaches agreement on at least $1.2 trillion in cuts over 10 years, then great. If it doesn't, then we're going to put this process in place for there to be automatic spending cuts in order to substitute for that $1.2 trillion. Now, the Congress, in its infinite wisdom, thought it had passed a law where the effect of the automatic spending cuts would be so abhorrent to so many people that it would force the super committee to actually reach agreement, because the worst possible thing would be to let this sequestration process kick in. But guess what? The worst possible thing happened, which is that it did allow the sequestration process to kick in. And without getting into mind-numbing detail about sequestration, I think the best thing to do is just to sort of point out that in general, sequestration covers a time period from fiscal year 2013 through fiscal year 2021. And in every year, there are an equal amount of cuts totaling about $55 billion each or $110 billion total per year, equally divided between defense and non-defense. So defense is going to be cut every year by $55 billion if the sequestration goes into effect, and non-defense programs are going to be cut by an equivalent $55 billion. Now, the $55 million for non-defense is divided between some cuts in so-called mandatory programs, which are entitlements like Medicare, and some cuts in domestic discretionary spending. So the domestic discretionary cuts, that is the appropriated cuts, are a little bit less than the defense cuts, but it is equal between defense and non-defense. Now, the notion was that Republicans would never put up with a defense cut this big, and that Democrats would never put up with Medicare and other domestic programs being cut. So the question at this point is, because it still hasn't taken effect, will it be allowed to take effect? President Obama, in his budget proposal last year, said, I don't want this to take effect, but he recommended a substitute set of cuts that would substitute, would add up to the same amount of money, but would substitute for the sequestration cuts. The Congress didn't go along with that, but they really have sort of three options at this point. The first option is to let it take effect. The second option is to come up with an equivalent amount of cuts but have substitute cuts. The third option would be to reduce the amount of that would be covered under sequestration, or somehow change the law, you know, from where it was, because, you know, I hate to put this flippantly, but it's only a law. And, you know, and laws can be changed.
How does budgetary uncertainty impact federal agencies? We will explore this question and so much more when our special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns. How can we enhance national competitiveness? What about getting big things done in government? And how can government better manage risks and use resources more wisely? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. Hear from Comptroller General Gene Dodaro, SSA Commissioner Michael Astrew, Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Robert Papp, NGA Director Tish Long, and Aaron Connaughton on the Air Force's strategic vision. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness with Professor Phil Joyce, a budget expert at the University of Maryland and author of the recent IBM Center report, The Cost of Budget Uncertainty, Analyzing the Impacts of Late Appropriation. So, Professor Joyce, you note in your report, The Cost of Uncertainty, that there are two things that make CRs hard to deal with for federal agencies. Could you elaborate on those two things?
Sure. One of the things that makes CRs harder to deal with for federal agencies is if they extend far into the fiscal year. One really interesting thing that I sort of uncovered when I started talking to lots of people in federal agencies, and this was really consistent regardless of what agency I was dealing with, is that this is now so normal, the fact that they are not getting appropriations on time, that people have adjusted their behavior to assume that they are not going to get their appropriations until around January 1st, even though they should be getting them on October 1st. But what begins to make it more and more difficult for them is if it begins to extend beyond January 1st. So one of the things that makes it more difficult is if you have late appropriations or continuing resolutions, but they extend past the beginning of the calendar year, because then there's just more uncertainty in terms of the eventual amount of money you're going to get. And agencies tend to put off certain kinds of actions until they're more sure of what their appropriation is going to be. So the longer that extends, the more they're sort of compressing everything they need to do into a shorter time frame. The second thing, and we kind of alluded to this further, that makes CRs harder to deal with is when there are lots of them. That is, when you have these shorter CRs, they cover a shorter period of time, like a week or 10 days. And I think the main issue with that is that it creates implementation challenges. Mm-hmm. There were examples that we uncovered, and also the Government Accountability Office did a great study in 2009 where they talked about this, that agencies actually end up doing a number of short-term contracts, so that where they would normally do a contract for an entire year, you end up having a contract that only covers the period that's covered by the CR. So you literally enter into a 10-day contract because it's only a 10-day CR, or a two-week contract. And every time you do another contract, there's more and more transactions costs that are associated with that. And frankly, there's more room to make errors, to sort of have audit findings later on, so that when you have these multiple shorter CRs, even if multiple shorter CRs might in total cover a shorter period of time than one longer CR, you know, having one longer CR would sort of be better than having a number of shorter CRs.
And your report does a terrific job of sort of outlining the ramifications of budget uncertainty and I want to talk about one area, and that, or multiple areas, but under the personnel workforce specifically. What is the impact that budget uncertainty has in hiring, personnel actions, and morale issues? And more importantly, what are some of the key issues facing agencies when they're dealt with that?
Well, the first thing that tends to happen is that agencies freeze hiring. And this is a rational response, in a sense. If you have uncertainty, you don't know how much money you're going to get, to freeze hiring. Now, sometimes there are what were kind of referred to in my research as hard hiring freezes, and this means somebody tells you can't hire anybody. But there also are what I would call soft hiring freezes, which is where somebody's kind of looking at the budgetary landscape and they're saying, I don't know how much money I'm going to get, and I really think it would be better for me to wait until I have a little more information to decide whether I'm going to hire somebody or not hire somebody. In addition, if they really think that a government shutdown might be in the offing at some point, this could lead them to sending, and sometimes they're required to send, furlough notices to employees. So to sort of say to employees, okay, we don't know if we're getting any appropriation on time. If we don't, then we're putting you on notice that you may have to actually, you know, take a leave for a while until we have an appropriation. One of the big problems with hiring freezes is that turnover doesn't occur consistently throughout an agency. So if you freeze hiring, you might have fewer people that are working in a particular area, and you end up with skill gaps in that area, as opposed to saying, well, okay, we have turnover of 5%, and that 5% sort of comes equally throughout our agency. So a hiring freeze itself can lead to kind of skill gaps in key areas. The second is that this morale effect, which I think comes partially from employees feeling kind of undervalued in this whole process, but also if you send somebody a furlough notice, it's going to get their attention. And one of the problems is that people may leave. And frankly, it is true in any organization that the people who are most likely to leave are probably the people that you least want to have leave. That is, they're the people who have other options. The people who don't have other options probably won't leave. So, you know, do you really want to put yourself in a situation where what you have is a workforce of people and the reason they're still there is because they actually didn't have options to go anywhere else? So I think that's a big problem that occurs as well. The other thing is that one of the first responses that many agencies make to having uncertainty in funding is to suspend training and development, to just say, this is an optional thing. We're not going to send anybody to training. The fact is that, you know, in an agency like the Department of Defense, you know, do we really want them to not continue training their personnel? I mean, for in any walk of life, continuing to kind of be trained and stay on top of what you're doing is what keeps you sharp. And I think that we have had a systematic underinvestment in training in the federal government, and I think a lot of it is driven by a lot of this budget uncertainty.
And you mentioned earlier the GAO 2009 study around contracting and implication of budget uncertainty. I'd like for you to talk a little bit more about that. How have agencies adjusted their mindset, and can you delve a little bit deeper into how budget uncertainty affects contracting?
Well, one of the things that I found that agencies have done is that they just don't have any or many contracts that are renewed in the first quarter of the fiscal year anymore. So they've kind of adjusted by saying we don't want to have contracts renewed at a point where it's going to be sort of uncertain how much money we're going to get. So you've seen dates for contract renewals sort of pushed back. Now I think that's a very positive response, but again, if you're trying to compress all your contracting activity into a shorter period of time, then it really makes it very difficult for contracting offices who have to kind of adjust to this increased workload in a shorter period of time. And the other thing that I think that this does is it leads to less competition. That is, if you're out there and you're thinking about contracting with a federal agency, and in the first place you kind of look at the general environment and you see all this uncertainty, and second, you end up with, you know, there's a request for proposal that's put out there and it has a kind of very short time frame for you to respond because the whole time period for kind of the review of contracts is compressed, you might just decide that it's not worth it. And a couple of people said to me when I was talking to them that this effect itself is not just an effect perhaps on the quality of service that federal agencies can receive. It also affects cost, because if you have less competition because you have fewer contractors that are kind of willing to play the game because the game's a difficult game to play, then that has the effect of because of decreased competition, actually increasing the price that federal agencies end up having to pay for whatever service they're contracting for.
And your report does a terrific job of talking about the impact to cost. And I want to talk about that a little bit more. And can you outline for us what are the consequences of budget uncertainty vis-a-vis cost? And would multi-year budget planning assist or remedy this issue?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that because the federal budget process, even if it worked well, is an annual process, that itself creates some increases undoubtedly in cost over and above what would be true if, let's say, you had a five-year planning horizon. I talked to federal contractors who said that the way that they deal with commercial contracts is sort of fundamentally different than the way they deal with federal agency contracts, because for commercial contracts, they can lock something in for 5 years and they can be pretty sure that, you know, that there's a sort of steady flow of funding. They can't be as sure in the case of a federal agency contract. Now, I was never able to actually get anybody to do anything except allude to the fact that this might be kind of generally true. But, you know, but I have this notion that there's a sort of risk premium that the federal government is paying over and above what would be paid if they were dealing with a commercial contract, because that additional risk, you know, has to be borne by someone. And it's almost as if, I believe, it's kind of an industry-wide risk premium. That is, probably all contractors charge federal agencies, you know, more than they otherwise would if there weren't as much uncertainty. Now, there were a couple of specific examples that GAO was able to uncover, which frankly are most notable because of their precision. You know, what you mostly get in this area is people saying, yes, the costs are higher, but not being able to actually point to exactly how much higher they are. The Bureau of Prisons reported to GAO that there was one prison in West Virginia that cost $5.4 million more than it would have been if funding had been provided on time. Now, the reason they knew that is because they were about to sign a contract at a particular point, and they knew how much they were signing it for. And by the time they actually delayed it to that later point in time, it cost $5.4 million more than, you know, than it would have at that earlier point. The other thing is that agencies routinely delay routine maintenance in response to funding delays and uncertainty. So, you know, just like if you decided to save money by not changing the oil in your car, eventually you would pay that cost, unless you could figure out someone to sell your car to who didn't know that you hadn't been maintaining it. But, you know, federal agencies can't figure out how it is that they are going to sell their assets to someone else in order to make it someone else's problem. So the short-term savings that is gained from short-changing maintenance leads to longer-term costs for federal agencies. And clearly, to the extent that you can tie that directly back to delaying maintenance because of uncertainty in funding, that's a clear case where there are increased costs that occur. There also are cases, it's a smaller number, but it could become a larger number actually as we are beginning to reduce the budget, where a continuing resolution, because it requires you to continue doing the things that you're already doing, actually requires you to continue to do things that you have already decided to stop doing. That is, in fiscal year 2013, you were going to close this facility, but now you have a continuing resolution and you have to keep it open. And you have to keep it open until the point at which you get a new appropriation, and then at that point you can stop doing it. And there were a couple of examples that people, you know, gave me of cases where, you know, where that was actually true.
That leads into the next area, the two areas I want to talk about besides cost, and that is when you adopt a late budget, it has to have an effect on the efficiency and effectiveness of government. Would you elaborate?
Well, part of that, I think we should start by saying that part of that is kind of part and parcel of, you know, if you go back to the question that you asked earlier about hiring freezes, for example, once you decide that you are going to adjust your personnel complement in order to deal with the fact that you might get a late appropriation or you might have a funding delay, what you are doing by definition is you are holding down the level of service. Mm-hmm. And so part of what happens is that you may be holding down the level of service unnecessarily because you're doing it out of fear of what you might end up with in terms of an appropriation, but you didn't really need to. I'm not saying it isn't a rational response. I'm just saying that you wouldn't have provided service at that level if you had just gotten an appropriation for the whole fiscal year to begin with. In addition to that, there are some years where agencies are instructed to actually prepare for a government shutdown. Now, the interesting thing, I think, that I found in my research was that, of course, we haven't had an appropriation bill. We haven't had all appropriation bills be enacted on time since the shutdowns of 1995 and 1996. So theoretically, OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, could have instructed federal agencies to prepare for a shutdown in every year after that. But they didn't, which meant that, in a sense, they believed that the problem would eventually sort of be resolved, that there would not be a shutdown. In 2011, they weren't sure because it really looked like, for the first time since 1996, we might actually have a government shutdown. And so they instructed agencies to prepare for government shutdowns. And this is just a complete waste of time. Now, it's not a complete waste of time if a shutdown actually occurs. But, of course, that's not a good thing. That's what you're trying to avoid. But any time in 2011 that agencies spent preparing shutdown plans and OMB spent reviewing shutdown plans, just a complete waste of time. there are also lots of conversations that occur after there is a continuing resolution around what is permitted under a CR and what is not permitted under a CR. It turns out that even the definition of what you were already doing, if the sort of notion is you shouldn't be doing anything you weren't already doing, that becomes a topic of some debate. You know, there are some agencies that say, well, okay, we didn't send people to this training conference last year, therefore we're not permitted to do it under the continuing resolution. Well, another interpretation of that is, well, you did send people to training last year, therefore you are permitted to send people to training again under a continuing resolution. Somebody is adjudicating those disputes. Somebody is, you know, is taking that information and is talking about those kinds of questions. And then again, we talked a little bit about this earlier, this idea that there can be many shorter contracts and, say, grant awards. Every time you have a new contract award, it takes time in order to process that contract award. So all of these things kind of eat away at the efficiency and effectiveness of government. And it's possible that any one of them may not by itself have a tremendous effect, but the cumulative effect of all of them, I think, is substantial.
And I'd like to stay on this point around CRs before we move to the other aspects of the society economy that get affected by this. And that is, can you tell us from your research, the short, long-term CR, are there positives and negatives? Is one better than the other? Does it matter? What has your research found?
I think that the main effect of a longer-term CR, again, one that extends, say, past about 3 months, is it just delays much more the implementation of what the real budget is. Mm-hmm. So the hiring freezes are extended, the procurement delays, the training reductions. You're compressing the time in which you're actually doing your real work, you know, into a sort of shorter period of time. So, you know, so you could sort of take that and say, well, okay, it would be better to have a shorter-term CR than a longer-term CR. That is, all other things being equal, a four months under a CR is better than 5 months under a CR, but not so fast. And my not so fast comes from the fact that you can say, well, okay, a shorter time period covered by a CR is better as long as that shorter time period doesn't mean that you had 10 CRs in 4 months. You know, I think that becomes the sort of countervailing issue in a sense, is that it's not automatically clear to me that one CR that covers 6 months, which is what agencies are under right now, is automatically worse, even though it covers a longer time period, than a situation where you might have only 4 months worth of CRs, but it would have taken you 10 CRs in order to get there. Because at least agencies right now are able to plan for this six-month window. I mean, their big problem is that they don't know what's going to happen after the 6 months. But at least within the 6 months, you know, there's some amount of I think, kind of reasonable planning that can go on.
And Professor Joyce, your report for the IBM Center, The Cost of Uncertainty, does a wonderful job of pointing out that the federal agencies aren't the only ones affected by this budget uncertainty or living on the CR, so to speak. State and local governments and folks that receive funds from the federal government are also affected. Could you elaborate?
Well, in the first place, I think it's important to point out that there's a significant amount of money that flows from the federal government to state and local governments. And state and local governments would like to know how much money they're going to get and when they're going to get it. And I think that the main difficulty is that they have difficulty planning for the receipt of federal funds, not only planning for the amount, but also planning for the timing of those funds. And I think it's actually really clearly illustrated right now in the conversation about the fiscal cliff. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go to state and local governments right now, and even I was looking at a website for the National Association of State Budget Officers the other day, and they have a whole report for state budget offices on, you know, what's the fiscal cliff and what's in it for you, or, you know, better put, what's not in it for you. And I think that the issue is that they don't know how much money they're going to get. You know, they don't know how this fiscal cliff discussion is going to come out, and they don't know how much money they're going to get as a result of this, and so that makes it difficult for them to plan. This also is true at the level of individual programs. That is, you can have individual programs that are the subject of some debate in terms of whether they're going to continue or not. And many of these programs are programs where there are applications that have to be received from state or local governments to federal agencies. And so you might have an application deadline for a particular program and put state and local government grant writing offices in the difficult position of having to kind of put a request in for an award for a grant, and they don't know whether that grant is actually going to continue or not. And there was a case that I found in the Department of Education. There was a program for teaching American history, and they had made the decision in the Department of Education that they were going to solicit the proposals because they knew that if they didn't do that, they wouldn't have enough time to review them and get the money out. And then eventually, when the final budget was passed, the program was canceled. So they had put all of these state and local governments through this whole process, which is not cost-free, of applying for a grant that no longer existed. And so that's just a kind of, a specific example, but I think it's a good example of the kind of uncertainty this can create for state and local government.
We'll explore what the future holds and highlight key recommendations from the IBM Center report, The Cost of Budget Uncertainty, when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns. The IBM Center for the Business of Government has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? And how can moving to an enterprise USA approach in government enhance our national competitiveness? This book explores these questions and so much more. Governing to Win is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher, RomanLittlefield.com. Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness with Professor Phil Joyce, a budget expert at the University of Maryland and author of the recent IBM Center report, The Cost of Budget Uncertainty, Analyzing the Impacts of Late Appropriation. Professor Joyce, I'd like to understand what prompted your interest in this research area, and would you tell us more about your study methodology and who participated in your research?
Well, the truth is that I simply believed, and I believed more as every year went by and we kind of were repeating the same dance that we had had in the past year, that at least outside of the executive branch of the federal government, many people were largely numb to the effects of funding uncertainty and government by CR. That is, that the assumption seemed to be that as long as we avoid a government shutdown, then everything is okay. And I wanted to document that government by CR is not okay. And, you know, it's hard to see for the people, frankly, who can do the most about this, which are members of Congress, where they see the effects of this. That is, you'd be hard-pressed to point to a member of Congress who was not reelected because they can't pass appropriations bills on time. And so there's this kind of notion, you know, implicitly that this is a cost-free endeavor. This is just the way we do things. And I wanted to try to document the fact that while it may be the way we do things, it doesn't mean that the way we do things is okay, and that if we could find a way to avoid doing it this way, there wouldn't be positive effects. In terms of how I did the research, I was lucky to have a number of reports, especially from the Congressional Research Service and the GAO, that documented some of these effects. And I know I mentioned it earlier, but you know, this 2009 study by GAO, if your listeners are interested in knowing more about this, this was really a terrific piece of work and saved me a lot of trouble because it documented a lot of these effects. Of course, it documented them leading up, you know, up to and including maybe around 2007 or 2008. There were a number of things that had happened since then, but, you know, but if they hadn't done this work, I would have had to, you know, to sort of recreate it myself. I then augmented that work with interviews of federal agency employees from a number of different agencies and also contractors and some representatives of state and local government groups who gave me a lot of good additional insights. And so this was, kind of a sum of this archival work, the work that had been done by others, and then this interview work that I did in order to augment that.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I currently teach at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, and we have at the School of Public Policy, we're mostly a graduate school. We have a master's degree program in public policy, a PhD, and several other master's programs, and we're really training the next generation of government workers, but increasingly also people that go into nonprofits. And so, you know, this is kind of what I do for a living, is to teach budgeting and teach budgeting to kind of bright young graduate students. And I've taught at several other places. I've been at Maryland a couple of years. I taught at George Washington University for 11 years. I was also at Syracuse University for 5 years. In addition to my work in as an academic, I have 12 years of public sector work experience, and I worked 7 years for the state of Illinois and 5 years at the U.S. Congressional Budget Office. And it was really the time that I spent at CBO that I think most sort of spurred my interest in this particular area. There were many good things that I got out of working at CBO, but one of them was to be sort of immersed into the budget process and understand kind of how it works and how it doesn't work. My research interests run broadly to the federal budget process and also to connections, either real or imagined, between performance information and the budget. I did an earlier report actually for the IBM Center that was focused on these linkages between performance and the budget. And I want to give a brief plug. My most recent book is on the role of the Congressional Budget Office in the policy process. It was published by Georgetown Press in 2011. But that's really one of my main interests is in sort of thinking about the role of information and analysis and how that information and analysis and how what I call in that book at least honest numbers can influence the budget process.
Well, that's a great way to transition. I when I was reading your report, The Cost of Budget Uncertainty, Analyzing the Impact of Late Appropriations for the IBM Center, I noticed the terrific job you did setting the historical context. But it doesn't stop there. You also outline very practical, actionable recommendations, and I'd like to explore each of them. Would you highlight the key recommendations you offer in your Center report? What are some of the key benefits of pursuing these recommendations? And more particularly, are there any significant obstacles to implementing them?
Well, I think, you know, it was interesting when I got to the point where I was working on recommendations. I almost kind of left this out, but I thought, you know, I could leave it out or I could put it in bold. And I ended up putting it in bold. And that was a recommendation that the Congress should just fulfill its constitutional responsibility and routinely enact appropriations before the beginning of the fiscal year. I mentioned to one of the people in a federal agency that I had interviewed that I had put this in the report, and that person's response was, "Did it make you feel better?" You know, and that was essentially to say, "Well, okay, but now what?" So the now what is, okay, well, let's say the Congress isn't going to do that. What are the things that we could think about that might actually make the situation better? There are a few of those. One of them is, I think that more funding should be made available on a multi-year basis, or what's called a no-year basis. Agencies that have less money that is available only for 1 year have an easier time navigating this process. And so to think about, are there cases where we can actually allow agencies to spend money over a longer period of time, as is true for the Department of Defense, for example. They have a lot of money that can be spent over a longer period of time. I think the reason that that tends not to happen is because the Congress is trying to keep more control. Mm-hmm. And so there is this sort of trade-off between the Congress having control and, you know, and agencies having more flexibility. But, you know, I think that the Congress should consider giving up some of that control, since the problems that are being caused by federal agencies are largely a result of congressional inaction to begin with. A second recommendation I had, which is one that strikes some people as sort of odd, is that the Congress should simply stop engaging in CRs at all. That is, the Congress should be prohibited from enacting continuing resolutions. Now, the reason that's considered odd by some people is that it actually flies in the face of what is more frequently a recommendation, which is that you should have what are called automatic continuing resolutions. That is, the Congress should not have to actually take action in order to pass a continuing resolution. If there isn't an appropriation, you should just have a continuing resolution. I think that just makes it easier to have a continuing resolution, and I'd actually like to make it harder. So I think if you prohibited continuing resolutions, what would end up happening is that you would have two choices. You either shut the government down or you pass a budget. And if that's the choice, I think it would make more transparent the effect of inaction, which is actually what I want to do. So that was my second recommendation. Third, I think that if there are CRs, they should not just be funding at the prior year's level, but they should permit inflationary increases. And the reason for that is because, you know, often what happens is, you know, because inflation is going to occur, a CR does not permit agencies to keep doing all the things they're already doing. It actually requires them to cut back on some things they're already doing in order to finance inflation, which I think runs counter to what should be the spirit of what a CR should be. Fourth, I think that the Congress should get out of the business, or at least reduce the amount that they micromanage the budget execution process. In many cases now, if the agency gets an appropriation, the Congress wants to see a spending plan from that agency and implicitly to approve that spending plan prior to the agency being able to actually carry out the budget. Well, that's fine if you did the budget on time. But, you know, if you're doing it 6 months into the fiscal year, all that does is further compress the time period in which the budget needs to be executed. And again, if the Congress isn't going to do its work on time, I think they should sort of not get involved in that kind of micromanagement. And then the final thing I would say is that if they're going to be CRs, they should be limited to a small number, one or two per year, that don't extend past the end of the calendar year. That we can sort of put up with, you know, the kind of 3-month delay in the appropriations process. It's not optimal, but it's not awful. But once you get into 6 months into the fiscal year, and once you get into, you know, 5 or 10 separate CRs, that's where the costs begin to really go up.
So as we close our conversation today, I want to get your sense of the future, the immediate future, given the fiscal realities of today. But more importantly, in your mind, do you think we can reverse the current budgetary uncertainty that seems to mark today's operation of the government?
Well, I think the two are related. If we actually were able to develop a multi-year plan for dealing with the fiscal cliff and reducing the budget deficit, and that plan established a path for discretionary spending, then I think there would be fewer things to disagree about going forward, and that might itself make it easier to reach agreement on the budget and make the process more timely. Now, then the question is, you know, the sort of, I don't know whether it's a $2 trillion question or a $4 trillion question, it depends on the day, but is the Congress, or are the Congress and the President going to be able to reach some kind of an agreement? You know, I've spent a long time, I'd say at least 10 years, being pessimistic about the federal budget process. I'm not that pessimistic right now. Since the election, I have heard a number of people say, well, we have the status quo. President Obama is still president. The Senate is still controlled by the Democrats. The House is still controlled by the Republicans. Nothing is going to change. I don't think that's actually true. I think there are a number of reasons to be a little bit more hopeful about that. First, I think it's significant that the president doesn't have to run for reelection. The president does not have to think about whatever actions he takes.